So, soon after the Buddha was enlightened, he went and found five old friends and gave a teaching, a sermon, that has been recorded as titled the Turning of the Wheel of the Dharma. And this is, in this scripture, he describes the insights, the understanding. He tries to formulate, put into words, the understanding that he had, the insight he had, the night of his enlightenment. And in some sense, this first teachings of the Buddha, the first sermon he gave, is the beginning of Buddhism as a teaching, as a teaching. And at first, it's recorded, the Buddha was reluctant to teach after his enlightenment, that he felt that no one would get it. And he spent quite a bit of time wondering what to do, and was finally convinced that indeed there were people in the world who had but little dust, only little dust, covering their eyes, their spiritual eyes, and that there was a possibility of clearing that dust and for them to see clearly this world that we live in. And so then he went about and started to teach. But I think we can easily understand his reluctance, because part of, I think, what waking up is coming to rest, coming to understand the boundless sense of presence that we are, that is within us. And how do you describe presence? It has no inside and outside. You can't really point to it anywhere. But we have a sense, I believe, what it's like when there's presence, when we're presencing something, when we have full presence right here and now. And what's beautiful about the word presence, the experience of presence, is that presence does not cling. There's no clinging in presence. There's no fear in presence. There is no hostility in presence. Presence is just a state of being that perhaps is our birthright. But how do you describe that? How do you point to it? How do you help people to understand it and to rest in it? It was what the Buddha grappled with the night of his enlightenment. Not night, but after his enlightenment. So he gave this first sermon called The Turning of the Wheel of the Dharma. And in here, he taught the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths was the first way in which he tried to formulate his understanding of freedom. And it was also, has become down through the ages, the core teaching of Buddhism. Almost all Buddhist traditions will point back to the Four Noble Truths as being very important and central. To varying degrees, though, they emphasize it. Some traditions will give it lip service as being core, but don't really explore all its implications and meanings. And it's said that it's easy to understand the Four Noble Truths. You know, anybody can kind of read a book and in a few sentences get the basic gist of it. But to understand the depth of it, the application of it in our life, is considered to be quite difficult. Or not difficult, but only someone whose spirituality is fully mature understands the Four Noble Truths in their entirety, in their full impact in our life. And I'd like to tell a story of a friend of mine who, when she was growing up as a teenager in the Palo Alto area around 1965, it was kind of the beginning, I guess, of flower power and hippiedom and things like that. And she was 15, I think. And she had heard that there was a Zen master, Suzuki Roshi, up in San Francisco, who could teach you how to get high without drugs. So she thought that was pretty good. So her and her friends went up there to find out how to do this. And he was delighted to see them, and he ushered them into the ceremony room at the temple, and then proceeded to give them a talk on the Four Noble Truths, which these 15-year-old girls had not come to get. And it wasn't exactly what they wanted. However, the way in which Suzuki Roshi talked about the Four Noble Truths, there is such thing as suffering in this world, that desire, God forbid, is a cause for suffering, that there's a possibility of freedom from suffering, and there's the Eightfold Path. the way he talked about it was so full of joy and happiness that the juxtaposition of talking about suffering and being so full of joy caught this woman's attention. And she went on now for 30 years to be a Zen student, starting there when she was 15. So the Four Noble Truths. In formulating his teaching according to the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha was borrowing from what was at the time a medical model or medical kind of way in which people talked about illness and treatment and recovery. It seems to be in medicine in the time of the Buddha, doctors would recognize the problem, would recognize the cause of the problem, would recognize the prognosis or the possibility of a cure, and then would recognize what the prescription was, what to do. And the Buddha simply adopted this and to formulate the Four Noble Truths, kind of, you know, Dharma therapy. But I think it's very significant that he chose a medical model, because a kind of therapeutic model, because it avoids metaphysics. And as we all know, religions and philosophies of the world tend to be imbued with a lot of metaphysical beliefs, cosmological beliefs, that sometimes are required to believe in order for the rest of the system to make sense. And metaphysics, you know, anyway, the Buddha was quite skeptical of all metaphysics. And maybe, I don't know if, you know, if it's necessary to be as skeptical as he is, but certainly he was very skeptical because he felt you couldn't really prove it. Things you couldn't prove, you couldn't know. You know, why hold to them? But more importantly, the Buddha felt that metaphysical speculation was of no real help to understanding liberation, to understanding our freedom. So he avoided that. He avoided dogma, he avoided belief systems, and rather he offered practices, and he offered insights that you could verify for yourself, not just have to believe in. So he offered a therapeutic model for understanding spiritual life. He didn't offer a metaphysical model for understanding it. And the Four Noble Truths, you know, they're kind of a very simplistic formulation. And as I understand them, we should try to understand what is behind the formulation and then personalize it for ourselves. Find our own words, our own concepts that work in this fourfold therapeutic model. When it says there is suffering, the First Noble Truth simply says suffering occurs. Okay, fill it in. What kind of suffering do you have? You know, fill in the blank, that's what it basically means. You have anxiety, you have fear, you have, you know, you name it. And then the second noble truth, there's a cause. The cause for suffering is, and the word is not desire, that trips people up, and inevitably there'll be a question and say, you mean all desire is wrong, or how could Buddhism be so negative? And the word is not desire, but the word is literally thirst, or can be translated as clinging or craving. But that's, again, it's just to kind of, you know, fill in the blank kind of thing. What kind of a shape and form does your craving or clinging take? And there's a whole wide repertoire of things that could you fill in that blank. Pushing away, holding on, addicting, hating, craving, defending, building up, becoming. There's many, many ways in which you could fill in the blanks. And then there's the possibility of ending suffering, of ending this kind of suffering, and you fill in the blank. You know, what is that like for you? And you, in your own discovery as you go through your life, in a simple way, in a day-to-day way, as you understand your suffering, the cause, how do you understand what the release from suffering is like? And then how do you understand the steps you need to take to attain that kind of release, that kind of freedom, that kind of happiness? So the Four Noble Truths. And the longer I've practiced, I remember some 20 years ago, I went to see an old friend of mine, and she asked me, you know, I just started kind of I started being involved in Buddhism only a few years earlier. And she asked me, you know, what does Buddhism have to teach? And I hadn't read much about Buddhism, but I was involved in practice quite a bit. And so I told her the Four Noble Truths. And I left her walking through the streets of San Francisco, feeling kind of how inadequate my answer had been, how simplistic it had been. Here I'd reduced, you know, this huge, wonderful religious tradition of the world to these four little phrases, you know. How could I have been so simplistic? I should have something wiser to say about Buddhism. And the longer I practice, the more I've come to appreciate the Four Noble Truths and their value in our life and the applicability to helping us clarify our life if we can take it really seriously. So the first noble truth is basically it says suffering occurs. It doesn't say, which some people think Buddhism says, that life is suffering. Maybe sometimes you feel that way, but it's not what the Buddha said. He simply said suffering occurs. And it's hard to argue with that. Some Zen students will argue and say suffering doesn't exist. Suffering doesn't exist, it's empty, but you know, you look at them carefully and you see they're suffering too. So it's hard to argue against that suffering occurs. So it's, you know, not a particularly profound truth. But anyway, it's something we find. And there's different ways of understanding this word, dukkha, suffering. And, you know, many Buddhist words, like dukkha, like dharma, like many of the words, the Pali or Sanskrit words, have multiple meanings. And so we have to be sensitive to the nuances, the context in which something is being talked about to understand its meaning. And if we just simply say, you know, translate dukkha as suffering all the time, we actually will miss some of the nuances of what's being implied. So, in the context of the Four Noble Truths, I like to distinguish between what I call inevitable suffering and avoidable suffering. Unavoidable suffering and avoidable suffering. Unavoidable suffering and optional suffering. And Buddhism is entirely about optional suffering. And that's what we have to understand, how it's optional, the mechanisms by which it's optional, how it comes into be. If it wasn't optional, there would be no possibility for a spiritual path. So there's the inevitable and there's the optional. The inevitable is the kind of stuff that just comes with being being human being, being alive. We stub our toe and it hurts. Our back goes out. And as some of you know, I'm quite fond of reporting that the Buddha had a bad back. So, you know, it's not like, you know, a Buddha is someone who's free of all possible illnesses and problems. A Buddha has those kinds of sufferings also. Full enlightenment doesn't mean you don't get a cold. So there's the kind of physical things that happen. And there's also emotional pain that it's inevitable if you're open to the world. It's reported the Buddha, his homeland where he was born, during his lifetime was attacked and many people were massacred. He was conquered. And he felt grief. He felt, you know, it hurt him to see that happen. There's empathetic pain. There's a feeling, you know, other people suffer around you, and we sense, we're open to it, we feel it, and it feels unpleasant. It feels like, you know, we suffer ourselves sometimes. And that's inevitable if you're open. It's part of being a human being, to be in relationship and to feel what's going on around us. And those kinds of things are not the kind of suffering that Buddhism is trying to make you free of. Now, maybe that's a disappointment to hear. You want a refund. But there is such things as just being a human being. I like to think of Buddhist practice as just helping us be more fully human. So then, so there's that. Now there's suffering we add to the inevitable suffering. So, you know, you get a cold, and then you get self-judgmental. You say, well, how could I have gotten a cold? I must be responsible. I did this to myself, and what did I do wrong, and this and that. And then we attack ourselves. Or we attack something else. Or we feel empathetic suffering of the world around us, and we get angry, or we get sad, or we get depressed, because we react to it with aversion, with clinging, with justification, with condemnation, all kinds of ways we react, and we add to it all kinds of complications. And what we want, in a sense, is to have uncomplicated suffering, pain. The kind of inevitable pain, is it possible to experience it in a straightforward, uncomplicated way? It's a life is a lot easier. If it's inevitable, it's a lot easier if you don't fight it. So there's that. Now, the Four Noble Truths is not really about that kind of inevitable kind of pain that might arise just being a human being. The suffering of the Four Noble Truths, the dukkha of the Four Noble Truths, has to do with a kind of suffering that occurs, the kind of pain, the kind of distress that occurs, the kind of anxiety that occurs, through the way in which we choose to relate to what's happening in our experience. So I call it sometimes relational suffering. But I got in trouble once because I used that word in a class on Buddhism at Stanford that I was teaching. And the undergraduate student wrote home to her father, who was a Buddhist, and said, "This guy thinks that all relationships cause suffering." You know something about inevitable suffering? But it wasn't what I had in mind. But rather, relational suffering has to do with the ways in which we choose to be in relationship to stuff. When we cling, it's painful to cling. When we try to hold things at a distance and push it off, it's painful to do that. And there's an infinite variety of ways in which we do that, nuances of ways. And it's that kind of suffering which is optional. Now, the way to take the Four Noble Truths seriously and Buddhism seriously is to be very interested in your suffering. And many of you are interested, that's why you're here. It's said traditionally in ancient texts and all, that no one comes to Buddhism except through suffering. That somehow or other, you might not know it even, but somehow the contact with suffering is what brings people to practice. So we're all in some ways interested perhaps in our suffering. Many of us are interested in not just interested in getting rid of it. We have something in it. But to study our suffering, to get it to know it. And if it's strong suffering, we're strongly motivated. But I find in myself, and I find in many people, that we don't often pay attention to the subtle sufferings. The subtle anxieties, subtle distress, the subtle complaint. You know, when you feel you're complaining. Complaining, I believe, comes out of the suffering when you complain, isn't there? I don't think you're complaining if you weren't suffering some way. Suffering in and of itself complaining is a kind of suffering. It might be very subtle. Are you interested to understand and see the suffering there? Buddhism offers a kind of very radical form of therapy or spirituality. And if you were interested in following through on the radicalness of it, the full spiritual potential of it, you want to take serious all your suffering to understand it, even the most subtle. To see, you know, to understand it, to be present for it, to allow for it, to be open to it, to see it, to understand it. The word dukkha, which we translated as suffering, it's closely connected to the word sukha, which is the Buddhist word for happiness. It has the same root, ka. But that root ka means, in etymologically, the hub of a wheel. And du means kind of like a bad hub of the wheel, and su means a good. But what it means etymologically, dukkha, it means a wheel out of kilter, out of center. And what is it that brings us out of center? And then that's a second noble truth, what the Buddha called desire. Or no, he didn't call it desire. That's our Western problem. We keep calling it that. He called it clinging or craving, literally thirst, tanha. There's some kind of hanging on to experience, hanging on to objects or what we objectify. And hanging on also means pushing away. And it could be very subtle, and it could be very gross, and it could be quite invisible. It could be almost hidden from view at times. because we don't necessarily have the presence yet or the awareness yet to see exactly how it is we're contributing to create the kind of relational suffering that's occurring in the present moment. And I think, you know, we don't see it. I think that, you know, you should be troubled when you hear this, I think. You should feel challenged when you hear this kind of teaching. Because probably it doesn't exactly jive with some of your ideas you have about where your pain, where your suffering comes from, what it's about. I think it's good to be challenged and to think deeply. Buddhism, as you know, puts a tremendous focus on the present moment. And part of the reason for that is that suffering only occurs in the present moment. It isn't simply that it occurs in the present moment, but the cause of suffering occurs in the present moment. So, this is the second time in this retreat I've made reference to another religious system. I apologize. Maybe I shouldn't, but you have in Western Judeo-Christian traditions, or at least certain strands of it, the idea of original sin. And as I said earlier, Buddhism has the opposite belief, more the belief in original sinlessness, original purity. But there is a notion you find in some strands of Judeo-Christianity that original sin is something you carry with you through time. And it's because of something happened in the past that we are sinful now. Buddhism is really absence of this. The causes of our suffering in the present, not the causes, the conditions, the kind of stuff that comes together to create it, might have started in the past. There's no denying that at all. But you only suffer in the present moment because the suffering is being created in the present moment by some variety, some variation of grasping or pushing away. And so the emphasis on the present moment is to try to understand clearly what is actually happening in the present moment that involves grasping or pushing away. In the present moment is the seeds and the release, the cause and the release for our suffering. Now, it's often quite invisible to us because it's happening at a level that we're unconscious of, we don't see yet, it's out of sight, or it's very buried, or whatever. But that's where it is, that's what the Buddha taught, it's happening now. Our suffering is now, the causes of our suffering is now. So understanding the present moment, understanding, is really the place where we'll understand the Four Noble Truths. We're not going to understand it in the abstract, but in the present moment. So when we do this practice, we first try to stabilize ourselves a little bit in the present moment, try to kind of be gentle and kind to ourselves, and try to kind of maybe follow the breath, maybe be in the body, listen to sounds, do something that brings us into the present moment more fully. And sometimes we can do that and sometimes we can. But if we can, then we try to do that. Because once we can be a little bit in the present moment, then we can begin exploring what is actually the causes, what is actually the suffering here, and how, what is the tightness, what is the holding, what is the pushing away that might be the cause of it. And sometimes what I see happen is that often we're very selective in how we're looking, how we're focusing, in such a way that we're bypassing our suffering. So, for example, say you're feeling frustrated in your practice. So you think, well, I better try to get into the present moment. I think I'll hang on to that breath like it's the end of the world and just, you know, not let it go. But that's not really acknowledging your suffering. And as long as you try to stay with the breath, you don't really acknowledge your suffering, and you might never see then that the frustration there, that moment, is caused by a judgment. The judgment that you're supposed to be calm. And you're holding up this idea, holding, literally, maybe clinging, that you need to be a calm person for whatever reason. You're not really an adequate or person. You're not a perfect person yet. You can't really go talk to the teacher and present yourself until you've gotten the modicum of calm. You know? And And so that, you know, that's the holding behind the frustration. So to see this clearly, sometimes we need to kind of back off from the breath, back off from the selectivity of what we're looking at, and see what is actually going on here. Is there something different going on? And sometimes you want to have the widest possible pasture, widest possible angle lens, because that's where it's really happening. Sometimes you want to have a very, very focused lens to see the very minutiae, the detail of what's going on. So Buddhism has a lot of lists, and there's a list of the four kinds of graspings, the four kinds of thirsts. And these are the amount of different kinds of graspings you're allowed to have. So I thought it might be interesting to go over the list, and I'd like to change the order, because I have a sense that if I announce that I'm going to go kind of list, go over through a list of the four graspings, the four things we attach to, that some of you are going to go, oh my God, Buddhism is so down of a religion. Here they're going to take away this from me and that from me, and it's just all about, you know, what's problematic, and I have to give up something I don't want to give up, whatever. So some kind of protest might go up. So I redo the order. Because the first one, the first thing in the list, the first one in the list is precepts and practice, ethics and spiritual practice. Whew, I can let go of that. So that sounds like we're on a good footing here. It isn't that you're supposed to let go of spiritual practice and ethics. It's one of the places where human beings tend to grasp, hold. And then because of that grasping, tend to cause suffering. And grasping onto practices and ethics also causes a lot of suffering to people around you. But grasping onto precepts and practice, and I see it a lot in all of us, I include myself, grasping onto practice in order to, whatever, in order to be freed from being able to have any kind of suffering at all. Grasping onto practice in order to prove who we are. Grasping onto practice to have an identity. Grasping onto practice to run away from our life. Grasping onto practice, same thing for ethics. Grasping onto precepts and ethics. And it becomes, sometimes practice becomes a veil from really letting us be fully present. I think we need to be very careful that our practice helping us become present rather than actually paradoxically taking us away from presence, which it happens sometimes. And I think, you know, there's some kind of attachment around practice is quite common. I think all of you have experienced it in these days, because it's fairly common at some point or other to maybe feel a bit frustrated with how your practice is progressing here. It's not progressing fast enough, or the right kinds of experiences are not happening. These are to have ideas, attachments around the practice itself. So the second one, which is maybe the I'm thinking these days, it's maybe one of the most important ones, because maybe it encompasses some way all the others, grasping to, the traditional word is views, ditti. But I think it means grasping to any kind of stories. And one of the things that you becomes clearer and clearer as you practice is the degree to which the stories in our mind, the evaluations, the thoughts we have about things, how we react to them, how we believe them, how emotions arise out of them, how a sense of self arises out of them. Many of the emotions we feel, not all of them, but so many of the emotions we feel in our life arise because there's some kind of evaluation which was there first. And an evaluation is a story, is a view. So, say that one of you decides to give me that red Ferrari as dana at the end of the retreat. Now, that's nice enough. You know, I might feel kind of contentment or whatever, nice and happy. However, my macho self, my identity, will just feel ecstatic. That ecstasy comes from the valuation, comes from the story that I need to be a certain kind of he-man. Right? If I didn't need to be some kind of great he-man for all of you, you know, Ferrari, Volkswagen, who cares what you give me? But to the degree in which I hold the story, he-man story, to that degree I can feel ecstatic. So one of the ways that we have lots of ecstasy in your life is to be really successful in choosing the right story. Kind of anticipating what might come your way. However, you know, and then what happens? One of you out there in the parking lot, you know, you're kind of in quiet and going really slow, not so, you know, you're kind of present but not so present, and you're backing your car out. And this inordinate amount of fear arises as you're heading, backing up towards the Ferrari. And the degree to which the fear is there has something to do with, again, this identity of being a he-man. I mean, imagine if that Ferrari was banged up. I would be embarrassed to go to downtown Santa Cruz. So there's a threat to my identity. So some of the fear arises from that threat. Or anger. So you not only you threaten to bang into it, but you take your little Volkswagen and you ram right into it. And I get angry. How much of that anger is come, the strength of it comes again from the fact that what's been attacked is not so much my Volkswagen, my Ferrari, but what's been attacked is my identity that I'm holding on to. Boredom often is related to identity. Sometimes. So I'm not saying this is the source of all emotions, but a lot of our emotional life arises out of some evaluation, some story, some idea that is there first. So you might, at some point, as you practice mindfulness, become aware of your thoughts and your stories, the meaning you impose on experiences. The proverbial story of someone coming late for an appointment, not showing up for an appointment. Can I give this example already? No. Maybe I did it in an interview. You know, someone comes late doesn't show up for an appointment. And all you know in the present moment is you had the date, you had the time, you're standing on the street corner, and it's cold, you know, it's wet or whatever, and the person didn't show up. That's all that's happening, literally. The person did. To that, we add a story. We impute meaning. This means that the person doesn't like me, disrespects me, is this and that about me. So he had this story, oh, this person disrespects me. I asked them to come on time, they're always late. I asked them this time, it was really important. The person didn't come on time. Here's another example of the person disrespecting me. And once you have that evaluation, anger arises. Anger doesn't arise simply because you're standing on a street corner and you had a date and you're standing there on a street corner and no one shows up. Anger arises because of the evaluation that was there, the story. And we often, what we do is we fixate on the story, we attach to the story, and the clinging and the attachment and the aversion arises out of that story. And maybe the story is true, and maybe the story is not. But the story is just the software. We confuse the software for hardware in the computer of our life. It's just software. We need to hold it very lightly, because it might not be true. And you know, this proverbial story is maybe the person was in a terrible accident. And you hear, they're in the emergency ward clinging onto their life, and suddenly you feel all this regret and sadness and forgiveness for what, you know, how you felt for them. Because you realize, you know, it had no basis in fact that they were disrespectful for you. Until you know, you don't know. Until you actually talk to them or find out. You have to hold your story, your evaluation very lightly. Otherwise, you know, spin out. I love the story that Sylvia Boorstein tells of deciding to go on retreat at the Zen Center in San Francisco, kind of personal retreat, self-retreat. And so she called up and said, I would like to, you know, sign up for a room, make reservations and make a self-retreat. And the person who answered the phone said, oh yes, but you have to talk to Robert, the guest manager. And he's not around right now, but he'll call you back. So Robert called her back later, but she wasn't home. So Robert left a message saying, this is Robert, the guest manager. I'm returning your call. Please call me back. So she called back later, and no, Robert wasn't around. At which point Sylvia said, I think this means that I'm not supposed to come to Zen Center. And the person on the other line of the phone said, oh, I think it just simply means Robert's not here right now. So stories, our views, our opinions, we hold on to them so preciously, so cherishingly, for all kinds of reasons. So that's another form of attachment we have, of clinging, holding, that causes suffering. A variation, almost, a variation on this kind of view, a kind of view that gets its own category in these four graspings, is grasping to self. And self is just another idea, again, it's just a view, but it has a view that's very powerful for us, and we have all these ideas of who we are and who we need to be, or who we shouldn't be, but maybe we are and we're afraid, or whatever. We have all these ideas of what the self is. The self has needs. So you need this and you need that. The self has, you know, identities. It wants to become something. There's a tremendous difference in Buddhism between having an identity and identifying. You're welcome to have an identity if you happen to have one. You know, Buddhism is not going to try to take it away from you. You know, if you're a woman, I mean, be a woman if that's what you want to be. If you're a man, you're fine. If you want to be a certain kind of man, you know, fine, whatever. But identifying, so identity is just kind of what's there, in a sense. Identifying is the creation of an identity, and then holding on to it. Or taking an identity maybe you already have, and imputing meaning to it and importance, and then holding on to the identification, what we're creating out of it, rather than just simply allowing you to be the way you are. It's interesting to me that we talk a lot, it's kind of like the part of the dogma of Vipassana movement in America, or Theravada Buddhism. We talk endlessly about the three characteristics, impermanence, no self, and suffering. But I seldom hear, actually, people express the nuances of these teachings. The Pali formula for three characteristics is all dharmas, in this case you might as well say all things, are impermanent. All things are without self. But then it does not say all things are suffering, all dharmas are suffering. The formula gets changed and it says sabbe sankhara dukkha. All sankharas, all constructions, sankharas literally means constructions, formations, mental formations, are suffering. When we construct an identity, we construct how we have to be and hold on to that, that is suffering. Again, you see the relational, the optional, when we get involved with something rather than letting ourselves be just the way we are. I mean, it's fine for me to be a man, right? I mean, you're not going to deny me that, are you? But look at all the suffering it creates when I become a he-man. And I have to be it, and I'm frightened when I'm not, and I have to defend it at all costs. And it's just, you know, it's exhausting. The amount of the expense of the gym. Not to mention the, you know, the clothes and the gold watches and the repair costs and that Ferrari that you're... It's a lot of work to to maintain an identification. To maintain an identity costs a lot of work. To have an identity is free. To maintain it takes a lot of work. The fourth, which is actually the first, but if I said the fourth first, then you know you have to be this, maybe this drop of enthusiasm. But now it's maybe safe. The fourth grasping is sensual pleasures, sensual desires. It isn't that sensual pleasures is wrong. You're welcome to have all the sensual pleasures that life brings you. It's a source of suffering to grasp on them. It's one of the great places we grasp is sensual pleasure. I talked about that some when I talked about the hindrances. Who has memorized the famous Blake poem about a joy that flies by? Anybody know a little quadruplet, little four-line poem that Blake has? No? You know it? Oh well, so much for that. Something like he who grasps a joy as it passes by suffers. He who kisses a joy as it flies by lives in eternity's sunrise. Anyway, it's poetic. It loses something in the translation. So the attachment to sensual pleasures, the need for sensual pleasures, and it's pervasive in us that many of us feel that something is wrong when things are unpleasant, and something is right when things are pleasant. When I'm having a lot of unpleasant experiences, something about me is wrong. And I better do the best I can to get more pleasant ones. Unpleasant sensations is just unpleasant sensations. There's no story involved in it. Do we add a story, evaluation, to what it means? So the attachment to pleasure is often an aversion to discomfort. Is it necessary to have aversion to discomfort? Is it necessary to push it away, to hate it? Or is it possible to find a kind of a peace that is not, or happiness that's not connected to what is actually happening to us? One person, to realize there's a kind of happiness that's not connected to objects of desire, objects of pleasure. So we grasp to that. So the call of the Four Noble Truths is to become familiar with suffering, to be interested in our suffering, not to be morose or morbid or depressing, but because it's better to become awake to it and learn to mature beyond it than it is to remain numb. And so many of us are numb to our suffering, unwilling to look at it or running away from it. And then to become interested in the grasping, the holding, the attachment, the evaluation, the judgment, out of which it might arise. And to do this with tremendous compassion and kindness to ourselves. Because it's very difficult to be a human being. I think it's very difficult to be in the forces of our society and our family and our own mind, and all the judgment and expectations and fears and loneliness and depression and feelings of inadequacy and lack of self-worth and all the things that we feel and we swim in and are painful for us. It's very painful. And it's easy enough, I think, to take something like the Four Noble Truths and use it just as another thing to feel bad about, used to feel bad about ourselves. Oh, it must mean because I am causing my suffering. I am hanging on, I'm clinging to something, and now I'm even worse than I was before I knew about the Four Noble Truths. overcome any bitterness that may have come because you were not up to the magnitude of pain that was entrusted to you. Like the mother of the world who carries the pain of the world in her heart, each of us is part of her heart, and therefore endowed with a certain measure of cosmic pain. You are sharing in the totality of that pain. You are called upon to meet it in joy instead of self-pity. Overcome any bitterness that may have come because you were not up to the magnitude of pain that was entrusted to you. To be tremendously kind, compassionate, accepting, and forgiving. We don't have to be perfect. We don't have to do it right. There's no, you know, no one showed me yet the owner's manual for being a human being that says you have to do it right. And the third noble truth is the possibility of liberation. Or the possibility, maybe more exact, the exact expression is this: the possibility of the ceasing of your particular suffering, of your suffering. And you can see it. If you see your suffering and you see that suffering arises out of clinging, it's almost directly, immediately, you'll see, almost simultaneously, you'll see that if suffering arises out of clinging, you see, oh yes, there is a possibility of not suffering when there's no clinging there. This is the positive message of Buddhism, the enthusiastic message, the optimistic message, the message that within us is this pure luminous being, this great beautiful essence, the Buddha nature. Buddhism has a tremendous trust for our self, for our Buddha nature, for the possibility, our innate possibility of opening up, of being a human being, of waking up fully. It recognizes the suffering and it recognizes the great, that within all of us, no one's excluded, has the possibility of becoming free, of becoming awake. Generally defined freedom from suffering, sometimes you use the word nibbana, nirvana, in negative terms. Freedom from suffering is a negative way of saying it. Part of the reason for that is that it's very difficult to say what our experience is when we've freed ourselves entirely from clinging. And also because if we give it a positive formulation, oh, it means you're totally happy, then we become attached to it. It's easy to become attached to a thing, then make it into a thing. So the Buddha tended to be offer negative definitions for what this freedom was like. And one of the negative definitions is non-clinging. Buddha defined Nibbana, Nirvana, as a state of non-clinging. And non-clinging is the most bizarre, highest ideal that any religion perhaps could offer, because you can't find it. Try pointing to it. Where, you know, there it is. Just what, you know. Where is it? Even when you feel like there's, you know, it's not a, you know, if you're in a state of non-clinging, is it something, is it a thing? Is non-clinging a thing? Is something you're doing? It's an absence of doing, right? A certain kind of doing. So you can't find it. It's not a thing. It doesn't exist. So here, isn't it a bizarre religion? That the highest ideal doesn't exist? Well, maybe it's not so. Maybe it's not particularly original. Some people would say a lot of religions, their highest ideal doesn't exist. But that be as it may. I apologize. So, and that's the beauty. So non-clinging. But I say it now to encourage you to maybe give some thought and priority to this invisible thing called non-clinging. Because we tend to be so caught up in objects of things which is going to do it for us. You don't know how many retreats I've gone to and said at the beginning of the retreat, said repeatedly in the retreat, it's not about becoming calm. It's not about getting ecstatic or joyful. It's not about getting concentrated necessarily. It's about how you hold your experience, your relationship to the experience. What kind of relationship do you form? If what's happening, if you're really scattered and busy and confused, how do you hold that experience? Do you judge it? Or do you simply hold it with great open spaciousness? So I say this, it's not about getting calm. You know, it's about how you hold your experience. And then someone will come. Oh, it's so terrible, I'm not getting calm. Or they'll come in and say, hey, guess what? I got it. I'm calm. Well, it's nice information. You know, if you're calm, I'm happy for you. It's nice. I wish it for you. But you know, we take an object, a thing, to be the point of the practice, rather than being this. It's better to take this non-existent thing. You'd be much happier if you take a non-existent thing as the goal, the non-clinging. Non-clinging. Don't cling to your happiness, don't cling to your sadness, don't cling to your pain, don't cling to your joy. And to learn to appreciate this thing non-clinging. I think it takes an appreciation for what it is. Because it's not something we naturally learn growing up. Or, you know, no one teaches us in school, you know, non-clinging. But to learn to appreciate the value of it. And it sounds like, how boring, you know, it's nothing, you know, non-clinging, what's that? It's the door through infinite potential of who we are. In the state of non-clinging, you're open to a lot of potential. It's an openness to possibility. Possibility of freedom of choice, of nothing else. Possibility of new inputs, new experiences. It's very, very rich. The state of freedom from suffering. And these Four Noble Truths is not about some distant goal. You know, if I can do this for a certain length of time and do this and put all these pieces together, then I could finally perhaps have the ultimate bliss of nirvana or something. But for beginning to see the possibility, see, now, right now, what's the discomfort? Right now. Am I talking too long? That's not suffering. That's just some guy up here kind of ranting and raving. Just talking away. How do you relate to it? It's stuffy, you're tired. That's not suffering. It might be it might be unpleasant. Unpleasantness is not suffering. You hate being uncomfortable. You can't stand it. It's optional to suffer. It's not optional whether you feel it's hot and stuffy and tired. That's just kind of what's happening, you're sitting here. So it's in the moment, it's now. What's happening now? However, having said that in a very idealistic way, we should always be very leery of idealism. And the fourth noble truth is where the idealism kind of becomes more pragmatic or practical. The fourth noble truth is a description of a path that leads to the freedom from suffering, the relinquishment of holding of attachment. And again, I recommend you, this is kind of to fill in your blank kind of thing. But Buddhism does offer these eight different steps, eight different aspects that can help us. It's the recognition that it's very hard, actually, to develop the presence, the clarity, the understanding, the compassion, the kindness, the mindfulness, to see well enough to really help us with our suffering. It's possible, but you can't just simply expect to do it overnight. Sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. And so a realistic view then is that there are things that support and encourage us in trying to understand our suffering, the causes of our suffering, and the relinquishment of it. And what are those things that support it? And one of the ways I like to talk about the Eightfold Path, the Fourth Noble Truth, is that it's partly those behavioral things that is useful to do to change your life, to help you create the conditions that is possible for spiritual maturity. For many years, when I was a Buddhist student, I didn't think I had to change at all. I thought it was all about just sitting in meditation and having some great insight and seeing something and becoming free. And I can just do whatever I want outside of meditation. And perhaps idealistically, you know, I was young, you know, and you forgive young for being idealistic, but that's, it was kind of so, but as I get older, I appreciate more and more deeply the Eightfold Path, the Eightfold Path. That we need to sometimes, it's very useful, pragmatically useful, it's not necessary, you know, there's no law, the book says you have to do this, but it's very pragmatically useful to pay attention to your speech. How do you speak? How do you, what kind of livelihood do you make? How do you live your life? How do you spend your money? How do you earn your livelihood? How do you, what kind of actions? Do you follow the precepts? Do you live by the precepts? What kind of, what's your behavior like? What are the intentions that motivate your life? To understand very well your deepest intentions, your priorities. What are the stories, the views? You know, you can't really do without stories. So we have to have stories. But what are the stories that we live our life by? Are there more accurate stories, more useful stories? Views, right view. So to begin putting these pieces together, understanding in our life what we can do to make it easier for us to see clearly really the source of our suffering and the source of our freedom. So a simple example, if I may. If I'm driving down in rush hour traffic, and stuck in rush hour traffic, I might suffer and I might not. But if I suffer, it's my cause. I'm causing it. So I can pay attention. What's causing my suffering here? It's because I'm really attached to arriving someplace on time. Or I'm attached to speed. Or whatever. There's something I'm holding to, some idea, something I'm holding on to. And the slow traffic is interfering with my attachment, with my whatever. So I see that very clearly, hopefully. And in seeing that attachment, I can see the possibility of relinquishment. And then I can see, well, maybe I can't let go of it so easily, immediately. But now that I understand what the mechanisms are, what are the things I need to put into place so I can, maybe next time, not be so caught by the rush hour traffic? Well, maybe I'll choose a different freeway, a different time. Maybe I'll try leaving, you know, a little bit earlier so that I don't, not pressing, you know, up against deadlines all the time. And so maybe there's more spaciousness so I can maybe have enough composure to see a little bit more clearly attachment arise. So understanding how we can change our life to help support our life is what the Eightfold Path is finally about. So this is what the Buddha said. This is what the Buddha offered us as the core teaching for in a Buddhist spiritual life. I hope that you appreciate the Four Noble Truths. I hope that you reflect on them. I hope you're challenged by them. Perhaps if you get upset with some of the things I said, that's good. Because it means that maybe you're challenged and grappling. Maybe you'll come up with a different. Maybe Buddha left one out. But to really take seriously every level of suffering within us, even the subtle anxieties. I'd like to end with two quotes, if I may. One is the person, it's said in Buddhism, the person who becomes enlightened attains a certain nobility. It's the word nobility that's often used. Translation to English is usually nobility. And we shouldn't get too caught up what that means, but I thought this was a nice, interesting quote. Curiously, people resist the noble aspects of their shadow more strenuously than they hide their dark sides. To draw the skeletons out of the closet is relatively easy, but to own the gold in the shadow is terrifying. It is more disrupting to find that you have a profound nobility of character than to find out you are a bum. Of course, you are both. Some people may suffer a severe shock or illness before they learn how to let the gold out. In this poem by May Sarton, "Now I become myself. It's taken time, many years and places. I have been dissolved and shaken, worn other people's faces, run madly, as if time were there, terribly old, crying a warning. Hurry, you will be dead before..." What? Before you reach the morning? Or the end of the poem is clear? Or love safe in the walled city? Now stand still. To be here, feel my own weight and density. Now there is time and time is young. Oh, in the single hour I live, all of myself and do not move. I, the pursued who madly ran, stand still and stop the sun. Now I become myself. So I hope you can use the Four Noble Truths to become yourself.